For me, swashbuckling really is about it, it's an approach to solving unsolvable problems through preposterous acts of daring. You know, you could write a swashbuckling novel set in an office where the fundamental conflict is just there's a really cruel boss who takes over, who's planning on like forcing everybody out by treating them badly. You know, you can make it a drama by having everybody mostly kind of moan about it, or you can make it a swashbuckling story by having someone come up with like a preposterously daring plan in which they're going to like fight it at, you know, with joy and vim, and, you know, find all these devious ways to kind of win the day. And that's what I love about swashbuckling as an attribute of different styles of fiction, and what I love about swashbuckling fantasy in particular, because for me, it's something that when you see people attempting to solve these unsolvable problems with a certain kind of bizarre daring, it makes you change how you kind of see your own life and your own role. Like, why am I sort of settling for plodding through things? What if I try to do it, you know, bigger and grander?
What is up, everybody? You're listening to episode 99 of SFF Addicts. I'm your host, Adrian M. Gibson, and welcome to your weekly dive into the world of science fiction, fantasy, and writing craft. Joining me as always is my co-host, the Chewie to my Han Solo, the Joker to my Commander Shepard, my dear MJ Kuhn. How are you, MJ?
Hello, I am doing great. How are you?
Doing fantastic. We're almost at 100 episodes, which is fucking bonkers.
I know. I'm really so excited. It's so cool.
Yeah, man. Yeah. And if you want to support MJ as we roll into our centennial, you can pick up The Blue Baby, Among Thieves, her debut novel, and Thick Ass Thieves, The Green Baby. If you want a complete duology full of ass kicking and swashbuckling, perhaps, then this is the series for you. You can go buy this, and you can go buy Sebastian de Castell stuff, and enjoy your
a swashbuckling bonanza.
A swashbuckling. Yeah. Bonanza, man.
I love it. You can also pick up Mushroom Blues, in available now in all formats. So audio, ebook, right? Oh, maybe not audio yet, but
not audiobook.
Okay, yeah. Audiobook soon. But then ebook, hardcover, paperback. It's beautiful. And the future is fungal. Check it out.
And there are no psychedelics on the pages, so don't worry about that.
we cannot confirm or deny these allegations from Spencer.
It's a mystery. Figure it out for yourself. You're gonna have a great time. As well, a quick note for everyone out there listening or watching, the official SFF Addicts Patreon and merch store are live, so check the links in the description to support what we do here. Also, don't forget to rate and review the podcast on your favorite podcast app, and subscribe to the FanFatic YouTube channel, where this and every other episode of the show is available in full video. And now, joining us once again is Sebastian de Castell, author of the Great Coat series, The Malevolent Sevenant, and more. Welcome back, Sebastian. How are you?
I'm good. It's been a long time.
It's been a minute.
It's been a long 3 minutes.
Yeah. Literal minutes.
It's good to be back. I'm feeling pretty stoned though, because I picked up your book and list the pages.
Right. Just woo.
Brilliant.
Just, it's gonna be
there's
an interesting
definitely psilocybin in that ink.
Yeah. It's like the literary version of licking a toad.
Yeah.
You're gonna have a great time. Heads up, this is part two of our two-part chat with Sebastian, so I recommend checking out part one to get to know him better. Today, though, we're exploring the depths of our own daring and bravado as we talk about swashbuckling fantasy. So to kick this off, we're going to talk about misconceptions and just get that shit out of the way as soon as we can. Because when many people hear swashbuckling, I know I did for a very, very long time, they think pirates. But swashbuckling goes way beyond pirates. It expands all throughout the fantasy genre, but can you tell us what swashbuckling fantasy means to you?
Yeah, for me, swashbuckling really is about it's an approach to solving unsolvable problems through preposterous acts of daring. You know, you could write a swashbuckling novel set in an office where the fundamental conflict is just there's a really cruel boss who takes over, who's planning on like forcing everybody out by treating them badly. You know, you can make it a drama by having everybody mostly kind of moan about it, or you can make it a swashbuckling story by having someone come up with like a preposterously daring plan in which they're going to like fight it at, you know, with joy and vim, and, you know, find all these devious ways to kind of win the day. And that's what I love about swashbuckling as an attribute of different styles of fiction, and what I love about swashbuckling fantasy in particular, because for me, it's something that when you see people attempting to solve these unsolvable problems with a certain kind of bizarre daring, it makes you change how you kind of see your own life and your own role. Like, why am I sort of settling for plodding through things? What if I try to do it, you know, bigger and grander, you know? What I love about swashbuckling.
Ferris Bueller's Day Off came into my mind as you were talking, and I feel like that is a very swashbuckly 80s film.
It is absolutely a swashbuckling film, yeah.
Oh my God, I love that. Oh, dude.
I don't know why that was the movie that came into my head. It's a great film. Yeah, thanks.
And it's a film that, and you know, and why is it a film that feels so unique amongst that sort of genre of teen comedy? You know, because that is the thing that makes it different. He's such an odd character. In fact, he is in a lot of ways a kind of an antiquated character. Like Ferris Bueller is a young man out of time, so to speak. He's not of his moment. He's resisting it which is why, you know, and it's funny because even like the last song in the movie, he's, you know, dancing to, you know, Twist and Shout by the Beatles, you know, a song that was, you know, 20 years old when that was happening. Like, that's not the song that a teenager from the 80s was likely to be, you know, listening to. And so that's the other thing I love about swashbuckling, is that weird kind of, you know, anachronistic quality. It's as if it's sort of daring the present by bringing in the past.
Oh, very cool.
What a great description. Nice. Well, like, let's give a couple more examples just to really get our listeners in the like mindset to talk some swashbuckle. We've got Ferris. we've got
OG swashbuckler.
OG swashbuckler. We're not. We've got, obviously, your works, what many of your works is why we're chatting with you about this subject. But what are some other examples of books? Books you've read or written too. You can talk about your books specifically too, but like that encompass those vibes and like how they do that.
Well, you know, almost everyone's familiar with The Three Musketeers, which, again, if you think about what kind of defines that, it's not a historical adventure in which soldiers are doing soldierly things. It's a swashbuckling story, partly because there's the way that they approach things is so different from the way everyone in their era is doing it. And that's one of the things I find interesting. No matter what era you place a swashbuckling story in, there's a degree to which those characters are viewed within that world as being out of time, as being antiquated and anachronistic. Arturo Perez Reverte wrote a great swashbuckling novel called The Fencing Master. You know, he's an amazing Spanish writer, and but a lot of his books are translated into English. And The Fencing Master, Don Jaime, the titular character, is well understood by everyone around him as being, he's old-fashioned. He's, you know, his approach to life is out of date. You know, he's trying to be too gentlemanly, too sort of noble, too this and that, right? So even though it doesn't have that sort of comedic or flamboyant aspect of swashbuckling, it has very much that sensibility of a main character who is fundamentally seen as anachronistic, who is fighting their dissatisfaction with the present by embracing a set of values that they are attributing to the past, whether it's accurate or not. And The Three Musketeers was the same way. They were, you know, in the story, the Musketeers are kind of seen as being out of date with the present values. But of course there's all of those wonderful swashbuckling, you know, movies, the Errol Flynn movies. And of course, you know, the one that a lot of people sort of experienced, as their first, venture into swashbuckling movies, which was The Princess Bride. Which those don't tend to encapsulate the hero being, you know, anachronistic or fundamentally as much, but they do capture what you could call it, that sense of brio, right? Like it's the daringness. You know, as I say, like it's the, you know, do we solve this problem by trying to do it like the regular way or the hard way or the whatever you want? No, we're going to do the preposterously daring way. You know, we're going to challenge the very premise of how things work in our world. And that's something I love. But a lot of people, you know, Dumas is a very long read for a lot of people, myself included. And so if you're wanting to get into reading some swashbuckling fiction, I really recommend Raphael Sabatini, who was an Italian-British writer from the 20s and 30s. And Scaramouche was his book, was one of his more famous books, as was Captain Blood. And Scaramouche is absolutely wonderful, set during the French Revolution. And again, a character who is kind of behaving out of time, out of step with their present, which is another interesting thing about that people don't often notice about a lot of swashbuckling, especially fiction, where it's often actually quite political, like especially historical swashbuckling fiction takes, you know, a political step. It doesn't take the traditional sort of binary choice stance on political situations, which is, you know, very much, you know, the case with Scaramouche, right? The French Revolution's place in this backdrop. And there are two very good perspectives on the French Revolution that everyone, or the most people, are familiar with. But the main character is not seeing either of them. You know, he sees both of them as somehow fundamentally invalid. And again, invoking that sense of what is right, not in the definition of the present terms, but what is right in a broader, deeper sense that most people have already kind of rejected. So yeah, I love that defiance of swashbuckling fiction. That's the best part for me.
Yeah. Oh my God. I'm glad you brought up The Princess Bride. Would you say Inigo Montoya is like almost the anachronistic character? He's not like fully anachronistic, but I think he holds himself to like more classical values as opposed to other characters in that movie.
Yeah, no. And well, it's interesting because everything about the way that Inigo is portrayed is out of step with all the other characters in the movie. So if you think about it, in The Princess Bride, almost no one speaks in a sort of old-timey way, if you will, right? So Wesley speaks kind of as a regular, almost contemporary character, as does Buttercup, and even the villains speak in a, you know, kind of that way. The only one, Prince Rugen, I guess it is, played by Christopher Guest, this as a six-fingered man there. He has a little bit of that. And it's not for nothing that he is, you know, the nemesis of Inigo Montoya. Mm-hmm.
Right. I was going to say he's his personal villain, right? So that works out well.
Yeah. So maybe Inigo Montoya is the real hero of The Princess Bride.
That's right.
He's the real hero of my heart in the story.
Oh no, but
exactly. he's the hero of our hearts.
but there's an interesting phenomenon with that movie. First of all, it's written by William Goldman, the great legendary screenwriter, who also wrote, you know, All the President's Men and Butch Cassidy and The Sundance Kid. But he was actually a novelist before he was a screenwriter. And for those that don't know the story, you know, that he used to always tell is that he came up with The Princess Bride because he was on a road trip with his two daughters. And he said he was going to tell them a story to keep them busy. And he said, what do you want? You know, what do you want the story to be about? And one said, I want it to be about a princess. And the other said, I want it to be about a bride. And that's how he ended up with what was at the time a very odd title, The Princess Bride. And so that itself to me is wonderful because it's kind of a little act of swashbuckling on its own. But he wrote, I mean, it's such a wonderfully told story, and directed by Rob Reiner. But one of my favorite scenes is the sword fight on the mountaintop that everybody, you know, watches over and over. And I use it sometimes as an example if I'm doing like a masterclass on, you know, writing a duel scene, because you can really break it down and see how the story is being told. Like the sword fighting is lovely to look at, but it's the story of the fight. But the thing that's so wonderful about it is, unlike almost every other duel scene you'll ever see, where typically there's one character you care about and the other character that you deem as a sort of villain that you want to see defeated, it's one of the few duel scenes where you where you care about both characters. Like, what the stakes are not that Wesley will die. The stakes are that one of them will get hurt. And you want them to be friends. You don't want them to be enemies. And so it's really interesting to write, to watch a sword fight playing out where you just, you want them to, you know, find that, that reason to be friends. So yeah, I, that's a, it's just a wonderfully told story.
Agreed. And on the topic of sword fighting, that's one of the classics, but, and you've got extensive experience in sword fighting. I know that's played into your work with theater and fight choreography and stuff like that. But how have you used your knowledge and the time and research that you put into sword fighting to enhance the swashbuckling feel of your stories and combat scenes?
Well, it's funny, like, that's the thing. People tend to associate, when you say swashbuckling, they think of sword play. And so I'll often meet people who'll say, oh yeah, yeah, I'm a swashbuckling fantasy writer too. And I'll read their books and I'm like, that's not really swashbuckling. And they think it's swashbuckling because it's got swords in it. And swords isn't what makes it swashbuckling. You can have, you know, Joe Abercrombie writes characters with swords all the time, but, and it's gritty and gruesome and bloody and wonderfully dramatic.
Not swashbuckling at all.
But it's not swashbuckling because that's, the swashbuckling isn't sort of swords. But the thing that I learned, you know, it's been a million years since I was choreographing sword fights, but when you choreograph sword fights, you often don't have a tremendous amount of dialogue in the fight to work with. Like Shakespeare, you know, it's like if you read the old Shakespeare scripts, it plays, it just goes like, they fight. Like there's a stage direction that says they fight. And you're like, okay, well now you're going to have like 2.5 minutes of a sword fight with no dialogue. And so you have to tell the story of character, of stakes, of conflict, of twists and turns, even sometimes of humor through the way the swords move, the way the actors use the swords, the choices that as combatants, are, you know, people are seeing unfolding. And so when I started writing, it was just very natural to me when I wrote Traitor's Blade that every sword fight was itself a story. And not just a random sword fight. It's, you know, it's, and you have to set up the stakes for it and show, you know, what the conflict is and figure out what makes a twist, a sudden twist inside of that particular fight, or fight scene. And it's, when you do it that way, it's a lot more fun because it doesn't, you know, there's a lot of people who will often say, oh yeah, when I get to a fight scene in a book, I just kind of like skim over it. And so what I started doing, which I find is a useful trick for writers, is describe the intimate movements of the weapons at the beginning, but only at the beginning, because after that, the reader will choreograph the rest of the fight in their own mind while the characters are actually saying things and doing things and feeling things. And so you don't have to describe every movement of the sword. If you describe enough at the beginning that the reader can go, oh, I see how, to use the Princess Bride as an example, I see how Wesley moves, okay, and I see how Inugo moves, okay. And so you don't then have to describe every beat of the fight. You can then move back into the things they're saying to each other or feeling or the glares or the weather, because the reader's imagining all of the rest of those sword moves. And so that's one of the things that really it taught me, that I learned about sort of how to incorporate, you know, fight scenes into books and to make them really interesting. It's just always finding new ways to make stakes. And, you know, I must have written like, I don't know, 50 sword fights by now in my books. But for me, at least, all of them feel very different because they're all telling different stories. You know, one of my favorites in Play of Shadows, there's a duel scene in which Damalas, who, you know, he's one of these, he's an actor. And in this world, sometimes, as I mentioned before, like an actor will, there'll be a Varistor, where when they play a character, they accidentally channel the spirit of the historical character that they're playing. And in his case, he's channeling the spirit of the red-eyed raven, of like a character named Archduke Corbier, who was, you know, thought of as a horrible villain in the mold of Richard III, but was also like a devastatingly good sword fighter. And so he's in the middle, like he gets roped into this duel, and because he's sort of been carrying Corbier with him, Corbier sort of starts controlling the fight and telling him how to win and what to do. And so the drama shifts from how is Damalas going to survive this sword fight to is Damalas going to do something horrible because you know, Corbier has no interest in, you know, a nice win where the other person doesn't die. Corbier is like, once you've hurt someone, you better kill them because you don't want them getting better and coming back. And so you can play with stakes and play with story if you learn to just go, okay, I'm going to teach the reader the mechanics at the beginning of the fight in a subtle way, and then you don't have to keep going on about, you know, this blade and this high attack guard or all of that nonsense that people just sort of gloss over.
Yeah, because then you can give them the ability to focus more on the story itself as opposed to bogging them down in the action. You know, it's like, yeah, there is important stuff to be conveyed here, you know?
Yeah.
But it doesn't, like you said, doesn't necessarily have to be every specific movement. Cause then the reader's just going to get lost or bored, or they're going to gloss over it, like you said.
Yeah. And, you know, one of the reasons why Western audiences took to, let's say, the Matrix, the fight scenes in the Matrix so much was that you could break down every narrative beat in the story of that fight, of any of those fights. You understood what was going on. Whereas it's not as if hadn't been, you know, Western martial arts movies for forever. It's just that mostly they were like spectacle, and when they become just spectacle, then you just kind of tune out of it. It ends up being like, you know, the third act climactic battle scene in a Marvel movie where it's like there's a blue light coming down from the sky that's going to destroy the earth. And you're sort of like, oh, whatever. Like, I know they're going to solve it. Like, you know,
the stakes feel so meaningless at that point, you know?
Yeah. And that's, yeah. And, you know, if you think of like, I don't know, any of them, you think of like the parts of, and I love a lot of those movies, but, you know, my wife falls asleep in the third act of almost every one of those movies. And I'm almost like, how can you fall asleep? It's like, well, you know, what's happening, right? There's like a bunch of CGI people flying around hitting things. And then there's like a blue light. And, but if you think of like the stakes at the end of that first Avengers movie, it's like Tony Stark, right? He's about to die trying to seal that thing. And is he willing to? And because they've set it up pretty well with the, you know, with Steve Rogers calling him like just a kind of a glib playboy who doesn't care about anybody else. Like you have a sense of meaning to it. And that's always the challenge. Like fight scenes need to feel meaningful. Stakes are always intimate and personal, right? It's one of the reasons why you often will have like a stakes character. You know, if you're writing a book, they'll tell you like, if you're writing a book about like, okay, it's a zombie takeover of the world, right? And oh my God, the stakes are what? The zombies are going to take over the world? No, the stakes are the main character has found a little boy who lost his parents. And the main character is just trying to keep that one little boy alive because that little boy represents all those other things. And so that's a more general thing, but yeah, for swashbuckling, yeah, you got to make those every fight scene a story, because otherwise you lose that device, that narrative device of, you know, of a fight scene.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think, I mean, obviously the pacing of a fight scene is critical. And I think we've talked about that, really well here. I literally was just taking notes on my notepad here because I famously on the show really, really struggle to write fight sequences. So I want to talk though too about pacing for the story as a whole, because I think, you know, balancing plot and character and world building details is always challenging for second world fantasy and sci-fi and stuff. I think though it's probably doubly hard in a more swashbuckly story where it tends to be a little on the faster paced side, the ones I've experienced and read at least. What's your advice for balancing character, world, and plot to get all three across in such a satisfying and well-balanced way?
I think it's, you know, as we were sort of talking about a little bit in the previous episode, I don't know, weeks or years ago, whatever that was, back in the heady days of episode 98,
we've done way too many psychedelics. We don't know what the hell's going on.
Exactly. Yeah.
Lost track of time.
Jesus Christ.
I know. I keep looking the pages of Adrian's book, and there's just psilocybin on every page.
Oh my God.
No. It's you know, you have to go through some kind of a focal point, a lens. Like everything else, it's not so much balancing the ingredients as having a really focused point of view. And so for me, that's why it's always coming through character, because the character is your point of view character is who is experiencing the world. The colors only exist because the character is seeing those colors. And a color that character, if you have a colorblind character, then the colors they don't see don't exist from the standpoint of the story, right? And so, if the way to balance the world is, if you think about how we all experience the world, we experience it through, we experience cell phones as I need my phone because there's a person I'm trying to call, and if I don't get hold of them, something really bad could happen. We do not experience cell phones in terms of, 5G system that's at this set of megahertz and runs on this many transistors. And that, I always laugh about, like, when I read a fantasy novel where two characters, like two soldiers in a bar, are talking about, like, well, as you know, the seventh level of the dark blue blood magic is this. And you're like, those guys wouldn't know any of that stuff. And the people who do know about it mostly don't talk about it, because they also know it. Like, two plumbers don't explain plumbing to each other, and two people who aren't plumbers don't know much about plumbing. So when you actually really want to explain plumbing, you better have some really good reason why you're going to do that. Sometimes I would do it with, like when I was writing Malevolent 7, I remember one of the parts where I was just gleefully laughing as I was writing it was just actually going, if you really did have these mercenary war mages and there's these like 13 different systems of magic, there's got to be somebody who's got like the magic everyone thinks is stupid. And so that was like the Luminists, right? The ones who do like illusion magic with lights. And I was like, that it'd be like a running joke that those like Luminists always like wear like these super flashy, colorful clothing, and they use their magic. And like everyone thinks it's so stupid because it's like the dumbest form of magic imaginable. Nobody actually wants them like on a mission, right? Or the idea that totemists, the people that kind of use these different kinds of animal sort of symbolic magic, are always like annoying as hell, because like whatever their totem is, like they'll constantly tell you, oh yeah, like the panther is the greatest animal there is, right? But meanwhile, whoever's
so noble.
Yeah, exactly. We're like the bat mage. Like, no, it's bat mage, which is why I created Aridaeus Mosin, who is the one swashbuckling character in Malevolent 7, because he's a rat mage and he's constantly talking about how you don't understand. And he's like super handsome and really caring and dashing and all this stuff. And because I wanted rat mage to be, but he's always talking about, you have to understand, like, the rats are the most noble creatures, because they work together in the packs, and one rat will die for the other rats, and the rat will leap from somewhere to try to save another rat, and everyone else is like, oh my God, why is he still talking about this? So you need ways when you want to introduce like the world building elements of making it pertinent. Aaron Sorkin, who wrote The West Wing, is one of my favorite TV writers. He has a great device where if he has to do exposition, the worst form of exposition is one character says to another, as you know, the way the nuclear bombs work is, right? And so what he'll do is if he needs a lot of exposition, he'll have two characters argue about it. And someone will go, we've got to deal with this because those nuclear subs are going to, and someone else will go, don't, oh God, he's going to go through the thing about how the nuclear subs all have these keys and codes and you can't break the codes because they're all sent by this. And I'm so sick of hearing that. It doesn't. And the other person like, well, it works. You're like, no, it doesn't, because you can break those codes by this. Well, nobody's ever seen anyone break it. And you realize it's okay. The exposition feels okay because two people are actually having what sounds like a realistic fight about it, right? So instead of, plumber A says to plumber B, as you know, the number six ratchet, you have them go, hand me the ratchet. And then, no, not the number six. They're useless. They only work this way. And so he goes, I'm not going to give you this number 12 ratchet because that, I keep telling you that's just going to like burst the pipe. And like, that's what you have to do, is find ways to introduce that. So it's less about thinking about balance and more about balancing plot and world and character, and more about thinking about like being just true to a perspective and following that through. And, I was rereading Malevolent 7. I started rereading Malevolent 7 recently because we've just been negotiating a deal for two more books in that series. And it's funny because I realized like, oh my God, like the number of times I'm explaining how magic works is like mind-boggling in this story. And I intentionally, when I wrote it, is like, I refuse to write one of those so-called hard magic books where everything's kind of, explain, but it's only because I just love so much like writing Cade telling the reader, like shitting on someone else's magic, you know, or telling you why, how awful his magic is, or trying to tell, you know. And so for me, it just becomes, that's the story. So even though it's imbalanced in terms of there's a lot of world building, if you will, in there, but it's always done through that really clear perspective. And so then it just feels like story.
Right. Cause it's like using, cause it magic systems is one of those things that you can get really kind of over, just kind of like overhanded with, in terms of this is something that I need to explain to the reader.
Yeah.
But how can I do it in such a way where it's not like, you know, as you know, yeah, these are the such and such magic systems that blah, 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 blah. And that's the kind of shit that readers are going to get bored with. But if you have it in the sense of arguments or comparisons and dialogue that feels more engaging, that's going to be delivered in such a way where the reader is more, they're getting more enjoyment out of it, but they're also absorbing it more subconsciously. And we talked about humor last episode, and I think humor is a very effective way of masking information that you need to deliver to the reader. And I also think in swashbuckling, it's a very effective thing that kind of sets the tone and the energy for the story. This could also tie into things like pacing as well. Building on what we talked about last episode in terms of humor, how could you apply it specifically to a swashbuckling story?
Well, often humor is one of the distinguishing characteristics of that sort of swashbuckling hero, right? So very often you'll see, and actually The Princess Bride's a good example of that. Like Wesley is cracking jokes at the times where nobody else would. And it's part of, and it does, it serves two purposes. So one is it just makes him kind of endearing in those situations. And it really signals, if you have five characters in a battle scene, and one of them is telling jokes, not for the sake of just being the class clown, but telling jokes in the face of something terrifying. That's how you know who the swashbuckler is, right? Because that's who's going to feel like the swashbuckling character. But there's another part to that, is that the insistence, like we were talking about before, you know, back in, I think it was 2016 when episode 98 was on.
The hot year of 2016. Americans are loving that shit.
No, I've never recorded two interviews with this same outlet back to back. So I'm entertained. But humor is a wonderful act of defiance. And the fact that Wesley never still says funny things when the danger is suddenly increased, is like a kind of shield, right? That other characters will, in fact, try to stop him from making a joke, but he won't stop because that's evidence of that defiance. And we see that sometimes in, I think done in not as interesting a way often in, you know, modern sort of dramas and police dramas. Someone's been tied down and they're about to be tortured and they just keep cracking jokes and stuff. You know, so we see that use of humor for defiance, but in swashbuckling, it's like a kind of armor. It's almost part of the mask. Like if you think of characters like, you know, the Scarlet Pimpernel, by Baroness Orzy, you know, there's a character who part of their disguise is the fact that the Scarlet Pimpernel like makes these funny one-liners and things like that. And it almost creates something that you somehow can't penetrate, you know? So that's one of its uses. It's funny because when I write the Spellslinger series specifically, there's almost a hierarchy of that sort of swashbuckling humor, which is that if Kellen is on his own, in some kind of terribly dangerous situation, he will sometimes use humor as a kind of act of defiance. But if Farius is in the scene, it's Farius who makes, because she is the senior swashbuckler. So from a narrative standpoint, it'll always end up being her who's saying the kind of the funny thing.
I like that there's a hierarchy to that. I've never thought about that before. That there's kind of like a, there's like a, yeah, like a hierarchy of comedic dominance, even within like a group of swashbucklers. And everything that you're talking about reminded me, you brought it up last episode, but the movie, The Mummy.
Yep.
How there are different characters, like Brendan Fraser is prime swashbuckler, but then you have different characters within there who I can't remember what like the female character's name is, but her brother who's like, you know,
Jonathan,
really like,
come on, yeah, Jonathan. Man.
Yeah.
This movie was not
names.
Your bisexual awakening like it was mine. You clearly do not remember it as well.
Oh my God. They uncovered mummies and MJ's sexuality at the same time. But Jonathan, like he in certain parts would be kind of like a comic relief character, but only if the dominant character,
yeah, only if Brendan
played
ain't
by
there.
Brendan
yeah.
Fraser wasn't the one who was like coming in with quips and all that kind of shit. And even Evie would come in with like a funny line if she was in the hot seat. So I never thought about that before, but it is really,
yeah,
fascinating.
There's an absolute hierarchy of who gets to tell jokes in the Greatcoats, because usually like Brasty's always trying to be the swashbuckling main character, right, as if he almost senses that he's not the main character, and so he's always trying to like be funny, but then Falchio will be the one who sort of tells the kind of the witticism in the dangerous moment, and you know that things have gotten weird when Cass tells a joke, because he almost like never tells a joke.
It's when something is horribly wrong.
But that is cool, because then the narrative itself and the ways in which the characters are interacting with one another or with a given situation, those are very subtle clues that the narrative can give you as to like the stakes of a given situation.
Yeah.
Or like which characters are involved in this, and what do their particular actions reveal about what's going on?
Well, yeah, telling a joke, like the character telling a joke in a story, it's almost like it pulls the camera to them. Like whoever's telling a joke is the center at that moment, which I always think is kind of a fascinating thing. That if you have, because you can have, if you've got three characters and then one of them says the really serious, defiant thing, we will blah, 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 you know, I will face you no matter what, you know, whatever it is, right? Then it seems like that's the most potent thing, use of language. But actually, if another character tells a joke at that moment, they completely take control of that scene, of that moment. And actually, in our own world, right, like people often use humor as a means of taking control of the conversation.
Yeah, yeah. It is both like a defense mechanism and sort of like an attack mechanism all in one.
Yeah, no, it's absolutely, it's a shield. Think of kids in high school, like when somebody says something really hurtful or trying to scare you, and you tell a joke, you make a joke, and you, because that joke is your armor against having to respond either with, you know, aggression that you think is probably going to get you beat up, or timidity, which is going to reinforce that control someone else has over you. And so, yeah, humor is always kind of a way of reclaiming a certain amount of autonomy in any situation. So yeah, so it's you know, and these are all things that like from an analytical perspective are kind of interesting, but of course from a writing perspective, you know, it's less about thinking about it in those analytical terms and more about thinking of it as, why is this character telling a joke? Like, why do I want him to tell a joke? You know, what do I want to do? Like, a lot of language can, in books, a lot of the things characters can say can be sort of utilitarian or sort of functionary and disposable. But humor is one of those things where I think you, when you find yourself writing a character trying to make a funny quip, it should be potent. There should be a reason for it.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to talk about humor more, because I think, so the main character, or the swashbuckler, not always the main character, our alpha swashbuckler, the swashiest of all the bucklers.
The swashiest of all the bucklers.
So humor is a key element, I think, in most swashbuckling characters. What are some of the other key elements, like when you're building your, like the rat mage, right, I think is the key swashbuckler in the Malevolent Seven, right? When you're building those characters, what are some of the key things you make sure that you include as you're building them out?
I always tend to think that for me, and I don't know if this is how universal this is, but for me, the swashbuckler is always an avatar for a set of beliefs that most people in that moment don't agree with. Right. So even when they're on a particular side, the swashbuckler still believes something other people don't believe. You could have a World War II story. You've got a bunch of, you know, paratroopers or something. And it's not just that the swashbuckling paratrooper will say something funny or be particularly brave. It's that their reason for doing things will be something that the rest of that team is like, doesn't agree with or doesn't believe in. And that's why I say often those beliefs are functionally antiquated beliefs, right? They're deemed to be antiquated. And that's the thing. It's almost in one sense, I mean, I using sort of medicalized terms because I'm not qualified, but when the way people talk about people being, quote, on the spectrum these days, right? And I'm going to use it with the same level of ignorance that I think a lot of people seem like they do. In other words, I don't know all of how this means, but what we end up using it for conventionally is like people who don't quite fit the definition or like how we expect people to behave all the time or how we expect people to respond. And there's almost a degree to which like the swashbuckling character in some ways is almost on the spectrum in that sense. They're always out of step a little bit. You know, their responses are in a way always slightly inappropriate. Even if you want to think of it, like think of it in romantic terms, right? Where, you know, you have four people going by and there's, you know, and there's an elderly, you know, gentleman or lady, you know, who sort of needs help with something. And, you know, lots of people might go and help them. But the swashbuckling character, after helping them, the elderly person goes, oh, thank you so much. Will like give them a rose and go, this is the greatest honor of my entire year, this moment. You know, and it's like slightly inappropriate. Like it's slightly out of balance with what, and it's just everyone else will sort of go, you could have just helped them and not, you know, done a bow or done this other thing. You know, that's what's kind of lovely about those characters. They're, you know, and we have people in our own lives. I think we meet people who are slightly that way. They're just like slightly too far over the top. And they're evoking a set of values that we don't really think are very contemporary.
Yeah. And I think having that as a sort of distinguishing identifier about the swashbuckling hero or the alpha swashbuckler, however we want to define them, that serves as a very, we brought up Inigo Montoya earlier, that serves as a more distinct contrast to the villain. And I think swashbuckling really, the core of it really benefits from having the strong hero, but then having that strong antithesis to them and their values and their actions. And so for you, when it comes to writing a compelling, intriguing villain, or someone who is like even a little bit morally gray, you know, it doesn't have to be such a definite, like, this is a villain. What's your advice for making a good villain for a swashbuckling hero to come up against?
I think the best, so when I write a villain, again, I always go from the same standpoint. I'm starting from the perspective of the character. So when a villain's introduced, I almost always have the villain like seem like they're just virtually mustache twirling, like they're just the worst person imaginable, right? Because that's what it feels like when you don't know someone, but they're doing things that hurt you. You know, we think of them as, we don't tend to go, well, you know, I bet they've had a really rough week. You know, like where you like, no, he's pulling out your teeth with a pair of pliers. He must love
childhood trauma.
Exactly. Yeah. Everyone jumps into childhood trauma as their solution. But it's always like, you know, if somebody's pulling out your teeth with a pair of pliers, you know, and they're not a dentist, you're like, they must be the most evil thing that's ever existed. And Falcio does that all the time when he, in the first book, Duke Gillard is like the worst, you know, person imaginable, because you can only see him through the standpoint of what Gillard is presenting. And the more you go through the books and Falcio is forced to see these other sides of him, it suddenly becomes more complicated. And so partly what to me makes a great villain and what makes just great stories generally is think less of characters and more about relationships. What makes a villain interesting is when their relationship with the main character is complicated, right? In the classic sense, right? Darth Vader is easy to think of as a piece of crap in the first Star Wars. But once you know he's Luke's father and like he's actually got a part, he wants Luke to join him. That's, suddenly there's more complexity there. And that's like the very, very simple kind of way of doing it. But what I tend to do or try to do is because of what I was saying before, that the swashbuckler tends to represent a set of kind of romantic ideals that are antiquated, is I will tend to make the villain someone who is representing the actual pragmatic values that work and might in fact be necessary. So what I like is when my villain is someone who can reasonably say, in terms of what's best for everybody, what I'm doing is probably going to get us there, and what you're doing is not. What you're doing looks good and feels good, right? Everyone's going to cheer you on because look at you, you're fighting the big bad, you know, whatever, you're fighting the big bad banks, right? You're a great folk hero, except that if you win, everything falls apart. And what I'm trying to do, even though it's cruel, even though it's awful, it mathematically works. Like what I was sort of saying before when I said, like, I'm a classic liberal sort of humanist. Like my whole perspective on the world is like the function of societies is to try to build a place where people with radically different views and experiences can all thrive, even if they hate the things they each think, right? But what if I'm wrong? Like, what if that doesn't work? What if actually homogenous societies work better, you know? And so if I'm writing any kind of story like that, I look to create a character who, yeah, at first they're just going to look like total villains, but after a while you're going to start to realize, well, actually they have a point. Now, it doesn't mean that they're ultimately right, but you need to get like right to that edge, right? And even Duchess Patriana, who's like the absolute monster in Traitor's Blade, by the time you get to Tyrant's Throne, you realize like that the people that she ruled over who live in a very tough area to live in. It's cold, there's not a lot of resources, they get ignored by the wealthier duchies to the south, and she kept them fed. Right. And she kept them. And so they all think of her as the great hero. And when Falco discovers that in the fourth book, he can't believe it because he's like, no, like I know how awful and evil she was. And it's like, yeah, but she took care of her people. And so, yeah. So that's the thing to do is if you're trying to construct, like I say, because of the way that I tend to write, which is I start from that main character and I try to build out from every moment from them. It works kind of organically, but if you're trying to like plan it out, and some people really do like to plan out all their characters, is do it that way, is don't just take the values of your main character and then invert them. Make it that the inversion of those values is itself a kind of illusion. It only looks like they're the values of the main character inverted, but actually what they are is a much more pragmatic set of values that make the hero's values seem trivial. Right. That's the darkest moment I can ever think of for a character, is reaching a point where the worst thing the villain can do to a swashbuckling character is make them see that they're wrong.
Yeah. It's like the principal in Ferris Bueller.
There you go. Exactly. No, but if the principal was actually saying like, hey, you know what? Like you, all this stuff you did, like everybody cheers you on. And then like, but you know what? You've got a pretty wealthy family. And you're okay. And you're pretty good at school. Like you managed to get good grades and you can talk your way out of stuff. So you're going to college. But here's five kids who aren't actually that good and their families aren't in good positions. They can't afford to send them to school. They needed the scholarship. And because they followed your example, now they're screwed.
Yeah.
Like that's the dark moment.
Suspended. Fucking Ferris.
Goddamn Ferris Bueller. Dark Bueller is the villain of Ferris Bueller.
Come so full circle. Ferris is the bad guy now.
Circular storytelling, man. That's what it's all about.
No, you know, it's like they always say, you know, every villain is the hero of their own story.
Exactly.
But if you want to go, you know, really dark, you make the hero the villain of their own story. You know, and that's what that sort of darkest moment sort of means. And when you think about like stories as, you know, in some ways stories, even like when we think of just a bog standard, you know, it's a lead child, like it's a Jack Reacher story, right? Even like those books are still an exploration of something, right? Like, how do you deal with these problems, right? And so, you know, how do you deal with the world? How do you deal with this kind of problem or that kind of problem? And often, you know, too often the answer is like the more you punch, you know, just punch people, and that's the solution to almost all problems. And whoever can punch best is must be the hero. But when you want, when you feel, when you're writing a book, and I think this is especially true. I see this happen to a lot of newer writers, fantasy writers, is what they'll run up against. They'll hit that sort of 3/4 mark in their book, and they'll feel like it's not saying that it's become too vapid or formulaic. And so that's, if you have that feeling, it's a really good opportunity to go, you know what, make it turn out that, like, take it right to the edge where it turns out the hero has been wrong all along. Everything they've been doing that you love, that you want to love, turns out it's awful. You know, like, not to beat on poor Twilight, but you know, the whole sparkly vampire thing, like, just imagine the drama if you actually had a moment in that book where, you know, that first book where it's like, actually, like, you know, Edward, like, these people, like, their presence, like, it's done all these terrible things for everybody. And, you know, and actually he's like 200 years old and you're 16. Like, how, you know, let's look at the implications of that. You know, and you don't have to, because, you know, it's a fantasy and it's allowed to be what it is. And I always say, like, I don't think it's good to shit on other people's fantasies. And, you know, cause there was always, especially with Twilight, like, it really got beat up on with this, like, it's terrible, it's a rape story, you know, like all this kind of stuff that, and, you know, like it's so horrible. And I always go, like, man, you know, if you like have some faith in like 16-year-old girls that they're capable of having fantasies about sexy 200-year-old vampires without automatically going, and now I'm going to marry Larry King, you know, or like some 90-year-old guy. Like, they're not going to do, they just, it's their fantasy. So you have to allow for it. But if what you're trying to do is you're feeling like, I want to add some depth to my story, then, you know, the more you make the villain right, the seem right, the closer you bring the story to that precipice. And actually, again, Aaron Sorkin says this thing about, you know, always giving the villain a character, you know, a speech, like a moment where they're, he calls it like they're at the gates of heaven and they're making their case to St. Peter why they should be allowed inside. And so a really good exercise, I don't like doing writing exercises that are throwaways because they don't, you know, it's just not my style, but a writing exercise that you will almost never need to throw out is having the villain give that speech, the speech of why they were right, why they should go be allowed into heaven. Right. Cause you'll do it and then you go, oh shit. Yeah. I know exactly where to put that in the third act.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right. Yeah. I see right where that slots in.
Exactly.
Oh my gosh. This conversation has been incredible. You've given us so much advice and so much wisdom. Again, I've got so many notes now. But we're greedy. So to close out, can you give us some final advice? So, like, what final advice do you have for any writers that are listening that really want to just add some swashbuckling elements to their stories?
Yeah, it would be, you know, in addition to the kind of the two things that I sort of that we've hit on a lot, which is, you know, remember that swashbuckling at its core is trying to face an unsolvable problem with the most daring, ridiculous way of trying to solve it. It's the ultimate denial of the pragmatism, right? That's what swashbuckling is. And that second part, that of recognizing that that swashbucklers, that character is almost always evoking a sort of kind of antiquated values in one sense or another. And they might be actually futuristic values, but they're still behind where everything else, where everyone else is. They're out of step. They're out of sync with people. And the third one, though, is to remember that almost all swashbuckling is actually also kind of political. And so if you're trying to write something, if you want to put in a swashbuckling character, then don't be afraid to kind of ask some kind of political questions of yourself, right? Like, what are these times about? And what are these debates about? Because, again, you know, Scaramouche is a great example where it's, you know, the backdrop is the French Revolution. And that, you know, it's a very political era, and seeing how people kind of deal with that. It's just never a, it's not just for the hell of it, right? It's a response to external forces. And in some ways, you know, the reason why swashbuckling can feel believable is because if you just put swashbuckling in for the hell of it, right? If it's just character who's really great with a sword, who tells lots of good quips and, you know, is very romantic, it never feels like it's got real stakes to it. But the ultimate stakes for the swashbuckling character is that their values are proven wrong. Right. And that's what will give it that tension that you really want to see. Even something as light and fluffy as The Princess Bride, right, is a story about, does true love really conquer all? And that value is so out of step with what everybody else pretty much believes. And, you know, and Wesley, both Wesley and the grandfather, right, who are basically the sort of parallel characters in this, you know, from the frame story to the story. They're saying this antiquated notion of true love, right? He keeps talking about true love as if true love was a thing you could categorize, that somehow true love is powerful, right? And so the stakes that you're worried about in that story is actually around, does true love really, you know, kind of conquer all? And that's what makes it lovely. Even if it's something you don't particularly believe in, you could still enjoy it because it's trying to say something that is easy to dismiss.
Man. Well, on that loving note, We'll wrap up this mini masterclass with,
because this was true love.
This was true love. Yeah. It took us a while to get here, but it's true love, Sebastian.
There you go. And now I can,
99 episodes.
I can finally forgive you.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, and we'll see each other next time I'm in Vancouver, and you won't be spiting me in silence.
Exactly.
In secrecy.
In secrecy. All right, well, that's it for this two-parter with Sebastian de Castell. Thank you so much, my friend, for chatting with us about swashbuckling fantasy. We've got a little cat visitor to wrap this show up. But if you could let everyone know where they can find you on social media.
Well, mostly please don't find me on social media.
Online.
No, it's not. It's not that it's not lovely. I'm just not good at it. But on my website, www.decastell.com, that's DECASTELL.com. And you can just drop me a note on the contact page, and I reply to every single letter I ever get. So if you send something and I never reply to you, and you're not one of the people and you're not a Nigerian prince, trying to send me $250,000, because those ones I forget to reply to. Because I'm a swashbuckler, I don't really care about money. But if you don't get a response from me, it didn't mean I didn't send it. It means it got caught in your spam filter, because I do reply to everything. So that's the best way to reach me. You can find me at De Castell on Twitter or X or whatever that hellscape was turned into this week. But I don't usually respond to most things there.
Cool. And go pick up Sebastian's books. You got a plethora to choose from. You can also support his newest books, Play of Shadows and The Prelude, Crucible of Chaos. You can also follow SFF Addicts on Instagram, Twitter, Threads, all that jazz at SFF Addicts Pod. You can follow me at Adrian M. Gibson. You can have a wonderfully psychedelic time reading my book. You can go pick that up on Amazon, an ebook, hardcover, or paperback. MJ, where can people find you?
Yeah, you can find me across all the socials, Twitter, Instagram, TikTok, blah, at MJ Kuhn Books, or just mjkuhn.com has all of the links, including the links to buy my books. So go check out Among Thieves, Biggest Thieves.
And MJ's got a newsletter freebie. If you sign up, you get a free story.
Yeah, you get a free novelette. Do all the time.
Yeah. All right. Well, that's it for this week. Thank you, everybody, for listening. Now, keep reading, keep imagining. And we'll see you next time on SFF Addicts.